Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Mike Wolfenden. How are you, Mike?
Very good, thanks, Chris.
Excellent.
Thanks for coming to see us.
Yeah, no, it's nice being here. It's not too hot a day today. It's nice and cloudy, which is fabulous. My sunburn's starting to fade.
It's a bit of a relief from the very warm temperatures we've had, yep.
I noticed the Cornish Point wine, of all the wines, it had the vines are 15-year-old, yeah. You're saying, but it's the only one that sort of had a sort of a flowery, thymy type aroma.
Okay. It's getting complex here because we're not just looking at vine age, we're looking at different sites.
Yeah, exactly.
Too. So, you know, Cornish Point is a really unique site here in central Otago. It's a fantastic place. About 60-70% of the perimeter is water. It's on a peninsula at the meeting of the Cowra and the Clutha rivers, which are now a lake since the dam was put in at Clyde in the 70s.
So there's not a lot of turbulence there. So you're not getting a lot of humidity from mist rising off the.
No, we don't get those. We don't get those kind of effects. The effect that it has, though, is to really moderate those diurnal temperature swings to a point that Cornish Point is markedly warmer than the other sites. We'll typically start harvesting there first. The ripening potential there is greatest. The soils are interesting mixtures of schist gravels, river gravels, and some big blocks of limestone.
Oh, limestone.
Material. Yeah, yeah, big, yeah. Bands of it. We have what's called pedanogenic lime here in central Otago, being a semi-arid climate. It's not parent rock material, but it's limestone that's been formed from leaching through the soil, reactions between CO2 and calcium.
Oh, really?
Tending to be seen in bands at depths where rainfall has penetrated. But over there at Cornish Point, in between those bands of river gravels, that leachate has built up underneath those rocks,
yeah.
and formed really huge layers, which when we've dug soil pits, you can see the vine root activity to be very strong through those bands.
Okay.
of calcium material.
Well, that's for the moisture, isn't it?
They're humid, they're friable,
What's friable mean?
So it's easily broken up.
Okay.
We actually have some pieces over here on the shelf, which you have a touch and a feel of. So the roots don't have too much of a hard time getting through it. And as you pointed out, they hang on to some humidity. So that's starting to come through, I think, now in the Cornish Point wines, which as young vine wines, very, round, flowing, exuberant, big, rich, juicy Pinot. I think now, particularly in those typical vintages, 2012 was a good example, a very classic vintage here in central Otago, with most of the heat arriving through midsummer in January and falling into this period of big diurnal temperature swings for 3 or 4 weeks before harvest. That's a season where I think Cornish Point really started to show itself coming of age, where that exuberant fleshy fruit was matched with a pure crystalline structure that one might anticipate from that complex soil type that we have over there at Cornish Point.
No, I bet you guys like it because Fountain Road's a bit of a Burgundian and lime. Your followers, although in your toilet you've got a lot of Bordeaux
stuff. Yeah, those
boxes are on the wall.
Those box ends are a testament to Nigel Greening's old drinking habits.
Expensive drinking habits.
I think particularly some of those interesting Burgundies and Bordeaux.
Yeah, yeah. But the Burgundy has a lot of limestone going through it. So. You know, I imagine that's why when you got the hold of Cornish Point, you were quite happy.
Yeah, I don't know. We'd have to ask Nigel himself. I don't know if it was really a known at the time that he purchased Cornish Point that component of the soil type was really there, or if that's been more of a recent discovery. I think there was evidence of something going on chemically in the wines, which drove Felton Road to really research that.
Oh, okay, you didn't plant it up yourself, you purchased the land.
No, Nigel purchased the land and planted it ourselves. What I was suggesting was that I don't know if it was the depth and complexity of the soils there was a known factor in those early days. I think Nigel perhaps picked it out as a potentially great vineyard site based on climatic factors. It had famously been a great orchard site some years before. Certainly with the extra heat there, you know, the ripening potential is really great.
Yeah.
We can carry a really consistent yield there, harvest early, so we get really nice balance early on. But I think that balance is being helped by that that limestone influence in the soil.
All right, so in summary, just to summarise what we think is happening here, is that the vines when they're younger, more fruity, maybe less depth, and as we're going through, we're noticing that the wines aren't as exuberant, but you're getting more depth or harmony or rhythm.
More resonance. Depth, more harmony, more complexity, you know, rather than just hearing that one note being struck, you know, really hard and really loud, we're hearing a whole collection of notes being struck in balance with each other.
And what is it, why then, given that, are the wines getting lighter in colour and intensity? Because they are becoming that light. They're not as black as they used to be.
As the fruit, as the vines get older and the vine material and the fruit itself offers better balance and structure and depth by its nature, the winemakers here, I think, can step back more and more because we're going to be less tempted to intervene to fill in those gaps to help prop up that single note that we were hearing from the really young vine fruit. And so, as such, yeah, perhaps we're not seeking out the same extraction that we were. We're not doing the same number of punch downs in the ferments to help build a structure which would otherwise be lacking.
So the colour comes from the obviously skin contact, which is you're punching down, putting the cap underneath it
to an extent. Yeah,
yeah.
Although it's perhaps also it's a little indication of a couple of warmer vintages that we've had recently with some some earlier picking. And we haven't quite got the same skin characteristics to give us those dark colours.
Oh, okay. All right. So maybe this is a transient. I always thought, because alcohol's a bit of a solvent as well.
Yeah.
High alcohol means that it's easier, isn't it? Particularly during, is it later part? I can never remember.
Yes, certainly the extractions that take place will be greater with higher alcohol. So the fermentation process is broken down into three separate components, which... the whole process from picking to putting the wine into barrel could take 18 days, could take 28 days. Here at Felton Road, it's on average 3 weeks, and it's really on average, you know, three distinctly separate weeks. There's a pre-fermentation maceration.
So you just...
where there's no alcohol present at all. It's just an aqueous soak.
And that tends to give fruit to the wine, isn't it?
It's giving you flavours and aromatic compounds from the skins. It is bringing a lot of colour into the wine as the wine macerates there. We're trying not to touch the fruit at all during that.
You crush it first?
What's happened there is that whole bunches, that 20 to 30% or whatever it is, has gone into the bottom of the tank.
Yeah.
The rest has been destemmed on top. Not destemmed and crushed. The destemmer is held directly over the tank so that the whole berries fall in there. So then you've got, 70 to 80% whole berries on top there. We're then going to leave it to soak, and it's really just a decision to warm that tank up. And we're warming it from its ambient temperature, which is maybe sort of 11 to 12 degrees Celsius, mm-hmm. up to about 17. That's all it takes for the ferments to start. Here, those ferments, all natural ferments. We don't need to add any yeast or nutrients.
During the cold soak, you're just keeping the temperature low, though, so it doesn't.
Yeah, well, ideally, we've picked the Pinot in the morning, so it's coming at a temperature where it doesn't need to be adjusted. We'll do what's called a pump over on the first morning.
Yep.
So that helps to homogenize that tank. That gives us an accurate temperature reading, and we can chill it down if necessary. Once the temperature's at that sort of 12, 13 degrees Celsius range, we don't need to keep an eye on the temperature. We're already so cold here overnight. The wineries, those tanks are undercover, but very much outdoors. The temperatures will take care of themselves. You'll just need that little kick of heat to get the ferment started.
Yep.
The ferment then takes about a week or so, at which point when the ferment's finished, it's finished because the sugars have all been eaten up, the wines have gone dry, we then start tasting the wine every day. And once again, we're not tasting the wines looking at fruit or those kind of components that we look at in finished wine. We're just looking at that structural component again. And we're looking at tannin specifically. As we first start tasting the wine, we have these, you know, young, tight, astringent tannin, the type of tannin that you'd associate with if you're eating a bunch of grapes and you're chewing on the pips or chewing on the stems. It's quite mouth drying.
Yeah.
That's where it starts. And then over the course of that week or perhaps even 10 days, the tannin becomes more and more mature and more resolved. And it gets to a point where it's like a very soft, powdery, cocoa-like tannin. That happens in a kind of like a bell curve or a wave shape, and we're just trying to catch it at the peak of that curve, and that's when Blair makes his pressing decision here.
Yep.
That's one of the reasons I think that the wines here are approachable young, because that decision has been made to press on expression of tannin maturity. If we're pressed dry, the wine would, I think, perhaps eventually arrive at a similar result, but all that evolution would be taking place later on in barrel and then in bottle.
Yeah.
And that would take a lot longer in those closed atmospheres.
Speaking of tannin, just looking at the youngest vines versus the oldest vines, the youngest vines certainly have that more astringency to them, whereas the older vines, the tannins are a lot less astringent, if you like.
Perhaps... I'm sure that the tannin component is probably no less than it is in the young vines. It's just being balanced by
fruit.
So many more complexing things happening. You know, those you've picked up in the young wine that, you know, that there's some really, really strong characteristics that really stand out. Those are probably very much still present in the older wines, but they're just being matched by other complexing characters going on.
Giving you a more rounded feel to the mouth. Yeah. Okay, and just one last thing, on premier wine tasting. Have you done it?
No, I haven't. Well, this is kind of what we're doing right now, really.
I mean, I always find it funny that people can taste wines that are, to me, taste like half fermented grape juice, and they can go, "Oh, this is going to be great." Whereas, to me, I can't see the final wine in it. When you're tasting really young wines,
it's extremely, extremely difficult. As I've perhaps intimated, tasting the wines at this stage is very, very, very technical, and we're focusing in on particular aspects. You know, tannin. Acid structure, rather than looking at the wines as a pleasurable whole.
Yeah.
Because
some of them taste like candy floss gone wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. There's still a long, long way to go. No doubt. With many decades of experience, some people can get an accurate reading there. But here in central Otago, I think we're certainly going to be conformed to that another sort of winemaking cliche where. With those on-premier tastings, quite often vintages are declared as the greatest vintage ever, and it's amazing how many greatest vintage evers we have. You know, it seems to be almost every year.
I know.
At least here in a young region, we're in a phase. Although there will be ups and downs, we're really on this steep upwards curve. So I think it's going to ring true for us to some extent that each vintage, logically, all things being equal. You know, with the increasing vine age, with the increasing winemaking experience, with the increasing influence of good viticulture, that each vintage should be better than the last.
We're getting better,
yeah,
on average. Okay, then. Well, thank you very much, Mike. That's been absolutely fabulous.
Thank you.
Cheers, bud.